Welcome to a special hour of conversation on WAER that explores the Syracuse University Shared Academic Experience and Reading Assignment Born a Crime by Trevor Noah, host of Comedy Central's The Daily Show. I'm Joe Lee, and my co-host this evening is Brian Conkle, Dean of Hendricks Chapel at Syracuse University. Noah, a successful comedian, was born in South Africa to a black South African mother and white European father during a time where such unions were illegal under apartheid law. In Born a Crime, he recounts his childhood and the adventures he had with his mother during the last days of apartheid. Dean, you were part of a working group that designed the Shared Experience Project and chose the book Born a Crime. Talk a little bit about how that came about and what we hope to gain from this.
Thanks, Joe. Good to be here. The book was chosen for a lot of different reasons, not only because Trevor Noah is a popular television personality and the most successful comedian in South African history, but the book has proven to be informative. It's shown to be formative and really transformative. Because of this text, our students have learned a little bit more about who Trevor is, and as a result, they receive the confidence and, we might say, the freedom to be more fully who they are, not only as students, but as global citizens.
And joining us for this conversation are four Syracuse University freshman students who read the assignment and participated in the peer discussion groups. I want you guys to introduce yourselves, tell me your name and where you're from and what you're studying here at Syracuse University. We will start with you.
My name is Hadia Lee. I'm from Syracuse, New York, and I'm an intended economics major.
My name is Desi Kemajo. I'm from Rochester, New York, and I'm a CCE major, that's Citizenship and Civic Engagement and International Relations major.
My name is Brian Hudnell. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I am studying broadcast journalism.
My name is Allison Weiss. I'm from Montville, New Jersey, and I'm also studying broadcast journalism.
Fantastic. Welcome all. So we're going to divide this discussion between themes of belonging and identity, spirituality, and diversity and inclusion, and then we'll end with some of your reflections on the conversation and the assignment. But first, I'd like to get your general take on the book. But before we do that, we often in this country like to talk about what separates us and how we're different from each other. So I thought we could do a little icebreaker and see what kinds of things we have in common that are related to things that Trevor Noah talked about in his book. So I'm going to ask you to raise your hand and indicate if any of these apply. How many of us have praying mothers? That's all of us except one. I'm not going to out you just in case your mom is listening. How many of us have used an outhouse? And I'm not talking about a porta potty at a concert. How many of us have used an old fashioned down home hole in the ground outhouse? That's just me and the dean. We're showing our age. How many of us speak more than one language? That's Dassey and the dean. The rest of us have fallen behind. And how many of us have visited the African continent? That's two of us, Dassey and the dean. So we have some things in common. Some of us have some things we need to work on. So let's go around the table a little bit and get just your general impressions on the book when you read it, even going back to when you received it. Did you know that that was coming? What were your perceptions on having to read that and your general perceptions on the shared academic experience assignment? Hadia.
Well, when I first got the book, I took a moment and was like, okay, here's another assignment we have to do for school. But when I started to read it, I really got into Trevor Noah's voice, and I loved how he used humor to explain very serious situations. And it really made me enjoy the book and think about the book more critically than I think I would have if he hadn't done so.
Dassey.
I love Trevor Noah, so when I saw the book, I was like, yes, like a chance to connect with him and his story more. But as I was reading more into it, just his little, like, tidbits of wisdom and his, like, his whole perspective on apartheid. I've known about apartheid throughout my life, but reading this, it feels like, reading this personal account, it feels like I'm very in touch with the history and, like, how damaging the system was.
Brian.
When I first received the book, I was another summer reading assignment that we all have to do. But then you start reading the book, you gain some more insight on Trevor Noah, and I also learned a lot about myself. On the surface, me and Trevor Noah are two, you know, opposite people. Like, I had no idea that he grew up in apartheid. I just knew him as a comedian. You definitely get some more insight on his life and how he basically turned out to the person he is on air, and then you gain some more insight on him kind of off camera that I didn't really expect either.
Allison.
So receiving the assignment was definitely very daunting for me. I think that, like, when you looked at the paper, it was like you have to annotate, you have to research, you have to write down flashpoints. But I actually found that I had so many thoughts running through my head about, you know, his commentary about American culture and about South African culture and his comments about language and identity that I really had so much to reflect on, and I'm almost glad that they forced me to write all of that down, because now I can look back at the post-it notes and everything that I wrote down and kind of go back into my mindset reading it for the first time.
Excellent. Dean, I would say that a good majority of this book deals with themes of belonging and identity, more so than any of the other themes that we'll talk about. Was that your takeaway?
Absolutely. Part of that's the reason we go to university. Thinking about higher education, there are questions of belonging. To whom do I belong to? These are, in many ways, universal questions that we ask from the time we go into kindergarten, through high school, through undergraduate degrees and beyond. To whom do I belong to, and how do I fit in within that, and how do I not fit in, and how do I find my place? Trevor's story brings that to light. So we were delighted that this was the book that was chosen, not just for our first year students to reflect upon, but to galvanize the campus community to ask those questions as well.
And being born the way he was, a mixed child, under apartheid law, I mean, that placed extra emphasis on identity. So in South Africa, under apartheid, you were given a category, you know, so it's hard to run away from. You were either black, you were white, you were colored. On your birth certificate, if you were black and from a tribe, your tribe was listed. So you were given that identity. But it was a tough struggle for Trevor Noah to find his place in the world and in South Africa and under apartheid. Did you guys find that? Anyone have any comments on how he had to move between races of people, black, white, colored, how he had to move even among tribes. Dassey.
Yeah, I would say I connected a lot to him in this book. How he moved, how he used language to move was particularly interesting to me because like, I'm an African-American young woman, but I grew up in predominantly white schools. So you see, I definitely have a shift in my behavior when I'm around black people versus white people. I just feel I really connected to him in that aspect. And language plays it played a big part for him in his life. But just how you behave, you're like code switching, like it's a real thing, like you really change how you act around certain groups of people, and that's just to adapt and to survive so people accept you.
Yeah, laws were passed prohibiting sex between Europeans and natives, and later they amended that to prohibit sex between whites and non-whites. So obviously the title, Born a Crime, indicates that the circumstances under which he was born was illegal. And the fact that his mother had to hide him from society in order to protect him, you know, I think played a lot in how he identified himself. Any other themes that you pick up on in that identity piece, Allison?
Yeah, I was thinking about his name and the role that that played in his mom trying to counter the identity that was kind of put forth for him before he was even born. She named him Trevor, and I think that she explains in the book that she named him that because it was very, like, race neutral. It wasn't something where someone would look at the name without even knowing him and be able to identify him based on his race. And I think she did that because she didn't want him to have this premeditated, you know, identity based on his name. She wanted him to be able to make his own identity and make his own place in the world, just not based on any premeditated circumstances.
One of the things that struck me, and I should In the interest of full disclosure, one of the students here is related to me by DNA. That would be Hadia. So I know a little bit about her background. His struggle going between groups in school. Now, Dassey, you just identified yourself as a young African-American woman going to school in a predominantly white school. That's the same for you, Hadia. How did you guys identify with him, being from diverse backgrounds, but being in a school where not many people looked like you? How did you navigate your school community?
Born a Crime isn't a story about Trevor Noah discovering his identity. I never questioned whether or not Trevor Noah knew who he was. He was really trying to figure out how he was identifying himself for other people's sake, who he was in relation to other people. And as someone who went to school in a predominantly white environment, when that is not my race, that is also what I had to go through. I had to figure out how I identified in relation to the people that went to school with me and how that would affect how I behaved.
I would say I went to the biggest public school in Ohio, so I definitely saw a bunch of different groups within it, but it was still predominantly white. So I never really had to question how I went about my life. Like, I never had a question. Like, we all have our, you know, typical struggles with identity every now and then, but I never, like, felt pressured to act like I have to appeal to some group, because predominantly everyone looked like me, acted like me, and there wasn't really like a pressure per se to appeal to some, to a particular group. And in the case with Trevor Noah, he constantly had to deal with multiple groups, and apartheid really made it apparent that you have to act your certain way or else you're not gonna thrive in society at all. Like, it was very apparent that he had to feel that from the day he was born.
Dean, there was a scene in the book where he described in primary school, which was, to me, kind of heartbreaking. He was assigned to the smart kids class, quote unquote, in which he was, I believe, one of the only or the only student of color or colored student in that class. And then at recess, when he went out into the schoolyard, all the kids began to congregate in their own groups. So the black kids congregated with the black kids, the colored kids with the colored kids, and white kids with white kids. And because he was half black, half white, colored, I mean, he could move through all these groups, he was stuck. He said that I was in a no man's land because he did not know at that point which group to go to. Do we see that on our own college campus?
Yeah, so Trevor Noah, in the context of South Africa, is surrounded by the notion of Ubuntu, which says, I am because we are, or a person is only a person through other people. So his conception of identity, one might argue, is in relationship to his surroundings. Who am I here? Who am I amongst others? That's a question that I continue to ask in my life. And I would imagine that that's a question that our students continue to ask, to say, who am I actually? And who am I here? Who am I now? How do I relate in my context? I think that's one of the reasons why this book is so powerful. To see Trevor navigate that and meander through that throughout his life is a powerful lesson for each of us as we navigate the complexities of identity and belonging throughout our lives.
And it's interesting because I think it was Dassey that mentioned his use of language to move from between groups. Because he had knowledge of and could speak so many tribal languages, he began to talk to the black kids at the school and talk to them in their own language and began to get very comfortable with that group. And he credited that experience with him identifying as black. Up to that point in his life, he did not identify with any one particular group. And he said it was that at this moment, at this school, is when he began to identify as black. You're listening to Syracuse Reads, Born a Crime, a special conversation on Trevor Noah's book and Syracuse University's Shared Academic Experience Program on 88.3 FM WAER. your local NPR station from Syracuse University. What role does spirituality and religion play in Trevor Noah's life? We're going to chat about that after the break.
If you're Native American and you pray to the wolves, you're a savage. If you're African and you pray to your ancestors, you're a primitive. But when white people pray to a guy who turns water into wine, well, that's just common sense.
You're used to paying for media you value. Movies from Netflix, your internet connection, and your cable bill. Why not WAER? Contributions from our listeners are the most reliable share of the funding for WAER. Without your support, we couldn't bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, or any of the other programs you listen to. Now that you know how important listener support is at WAER, why not make your first contribution right now? Give at WAER.org.
My grandmother always told me that she loved my prayers. She believed my prayers were more powerful because I prayed in English. And everyone knows that Jesus, who's white, speaks English. The Bible is in English. Yes, the Bible was not written in English, but the Bible came to South Africa in English. So to us, it's English, which made my prayers the best prayers because English prayers get answered first. How do we know this? Well, look at white people. Clearly, they're getting through to the right person. Add to that Matthew 19:14, "Suffer little children to come unto me," Jesus said, "for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So if a child is praying in English to white Jesus, that's a powerful combination right there.
Welcome back to Syracuse Reads. We're discussing the Syracuse University shared academic assignment, Born a Crime, the amazing book by South African comedian Trevor Noah, who incidentally will appear at the 34th annual Syracuse University MLK celebration on January 27th. We continue our conversation now on spirituality. And I'm going to hand this off to the dean because that is just not my wheelhouse.
It really is a fascinating text about the ways in which religion and spirituality plays out on the global sphere and the context of religion and spirituality on the entire African continent, let alone sub-Saharan Africa, is of course incredibly complex. Missionary influences, indigenous spiritualities, and the complexities that result over the course of hundreds of years as a result of that. And this text brings that out, specifically in the person of Trevor Noah, the way that he and his mother navigate the complexity of religious and spiritual life in South Africa, where under the context of Christianity, the same text, the same Bible is used by some to oppress and by others to liberate, the same text. So I love the way in which he brings those issues to light, recognizing that these similar issues are things that we're dealing with in North America right now. How is it that religion and spirituality brings people together? How is it that we're real and honest with ourselves about the ways in which it divides? And how can we learn from this text amongst other texts and amongst the experience of one another to see what I would argue is what religion and spirituality looks like at its best, a way to bridge people together, a way to create the common good, to be rooted in a particular identity, and to be reaching to the identities of others.
So for those that haven't in our audience, the listening audience that haven't read the book, who wants to sort of explain the relationship between Trevor Noah and his mom in the context of religion and spirituality? And don't all of you jump at once. Allison.
So basically, Trevor Noah and his mother dispute a lot of the hard facts, if you will, about Christianity. His mother is a hardcore believer in pretty much everything that has to do with the Bible and Jesus and all things like that. And it results in her having this drive to go to church every single Sunday under really harsh circumstances. He describes this minibus system that was unreliable and dangerous potentially because they didn't really have a functioning and reliable car. And obviously, you know, as a young child and a teenager, he didn't want to have to get up on Sunday mornings and go to church for long hours, because he does describe that they went to a bunch of different churches because they got all different things out of those experiences. And his mother and him have these, you know, debates. He's like, how can you prove that this happened? How can you prove that Jesus and that God exists? And she kind of schools him on how much faith she has, and it's really evident how much faith has just helped her through the difficult life that she's had thus far.
I don't know about anyone else, but I got the sense that religion is a very complicated issue for Trevor Noah. After having completed the book, I wasn't quite sure where he stood in his religion, acceptance of religion, spirituality. What are your thoughts on that, Hadiya?
I think that he accepts religion and respects religion through his mother, but I don't believe that he himself is religious.
Dassey, did you anything speak to you about his actual – there was a part where he described that he was good at praying, and that his grandmother relied on him to pray. And the reason he gave was that because he prayed in English, and that because he prayed in English, they believe that English prayers were answered first. And so he got good at it. They asked him to pray for English, and he felt helpful in doing that. How did that strike you, that section?
The fact that they thought, like, praying in English was, like, it brought you basically closer to God, like God will answer your prayers more if you pray in English. I think that just shows the effect of colonization in South Africa, because you can see the effect of a Eurocentric culture, because, like, as it was mentioned before, that religion was used to oppress, and, like, it really was to take, like, centuries and centuries of, like, a different kind of spirituality religion when you believe in your ancestors and your spirits, and to take centuries and centuries of that, and then when colonizers come and say, no, this is Jesus is your God, Christianity, this is what's going on now, and to see the people of South Africa, I'm like, okay, like, this is the superior religion, and if you pray in English, not even the language that our forefathers spoke, then that is also superior. That just shows the effect of that, and I think the fact that he felt like he was helping when he was praying in English, it shows that I think some traditions of the faith were passed on to him, not necessarily that he might believe in all these things, but you can see the influence of the, not necessarily, maybe he doesn't believe necessarily in, like, specifically these people in the Bible and their stories, but he definitely was influenced by that because of his mother, and you can see in his, like, little bits of wisdom he drops throughout the book, it's not necessarily explicitly Christian, but you can see some of those teachings echoed in his, like, thoughts.
You make some great points, and I wonder if that is sort of the crux of his conflict, because he understands how religion was used to colonize. But on the other hand, he understands how much joy it brought to his mother, how much meaning it gave to the rest of his family. There's a tug of war there.
Absolutely. It's a complex issue. Trevor Noah is growing up at a time where he has an experience of one of the great moral leaders of our time, who happens to be an Anglican clergy person, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. So he's experiencing both and. He's experiencing this Christian tradition being used for oppression, for colonization, subjugation, and he's experiencing the same Christianity as a tool, as an instrument, as an opportunity to liberate the oppressed. So he's living into the both ends of those experiences, and he's grappling with that and struggling with that. So it's not incredibly surprising to see him articulate that struggle throughout the pages of this text.
I also think that, to go back to your point, at the end of the memoir, his conflict is not solved. And it almost gave me a conflict because, for those that don't know, at the end, his mother gets shot in the face. And it basically, the bullet misses pretty much every major part of her brain and her head, and she miraculously survives and Trevor thinks that one of the only explanations for that is that someone was looking out for her and looking down on her. And he's kind of inherently confused about that. And I'm a Jewish woman. I was bat mitzvahed. But, you know, I've been questioning and struggling with my faith. And that section kind of made me want to believe in something that much that it could actually save her life.
And to go into more detail about the miraculousness, not only was she shot in the face and survived, his stepfather stood over her and fired three or four more times, but the bullets of the gun just would not fire. And not only did she recover, but she recovered in record time. I mean, she recovered and was back to work within like 2 weeks. And so I think at the end of the book, it's like, how do I argue? He tried through comedy to debate his mother on the issue. But like she had always done, she got the better of him on that one. You know, so very, very interesting stuff. You anything to add, sir?
I think we can look at many instances throughout history where this is these unexplainable, you know, godlike events, and we really can't explain these kind of events. Like you say, oh, it's an act of God. Well, like they seem to happen throughout history, and Trevor's mother is another example. In my life, one of my best friends was in a car accident, and he was given like 10% to 15% chance to live, and he was not religious at all. But I remember my mom saying it's God watching over him, even though he wasn't religious. So I think there are definitely those kind of events that really you can't explain, but you can maybe trace it back to a deep faith.
And the conflict in him is the miracle of his mother, but also a lot of the negative things that he had to associate with, like getting kidnapped by the minibus driver. So a lot of things that happened early in his life, negative things, he attributed to them in their journey trying to get to church. So it wasn't that religion did anything, but in his mother's effort to seek spirituality and get to church, a lot of negative things happen. And so you have on one hand those experiences, on the other hand the things that he sees good. So there's this tug and pull again, this conflict within him that comes across in the book. And you're right, it doesn't get resolved, I don't think.
I think it's – some have made the case that the book, Born a Crime, is in some way Trevor Noah's love letter to his mother. And in spite of his own struggle, which is justifiable, at the very end of the day, he loves his mother, and his mother loves her faith. So regardless of his own experiences, I think that he'll always have that opening. And I'm speculating, but because of his deep love and care for his mother, because his mother cares about something, he's going to be at least open to it. And perhaps we'll ask him that question in a couple months.
You're listening to special programming on WAER, Syracuse Reads, a discussion of the book Born a Crime by Trevor Noah. After the break, we'll explore how issues of diversity and inclusion played out in Trevor Noah's life and find out what expectations and experiences our students have for their life in the SU community.
We spend so much time being afraid of failure, afraid of rejection. But regret is the thing we should fear most. Failure is an answer. Rejection is an answer. Regret is an eternal question you will never have the answer to. What if? If only. I wonder what would have. You will never, never know, and it will haunt you for the rest of your days.
As a public radio listener, we know you have a lot of different interests. And with our slate of podcasts, we try and provide on-demand audio for everyone.
This is Marv Juger with Science on the Radio.
From contentious public divorces to drunk driving arrests to private rants caught on tape, Hollywood figures are no stranger to the heat of the spotlight.
The NBA Draft Combine starts today, and every Syracuse fan is watching this guy.
Whether it's science, sports, or pop culture, we think you'll find something you can enjoy. Check out our selection of on-demand audio over at WAER.org or in Apple Podcasts by searching for WAER.
Apartheid was a police state, a system of surveillance and laws designed to keep black people under total control. A full compendium of those laws would run more than 3,000 pages and weigh approximately 10 pounds. But the general thrust of it should be easy enough for any American to understand. In America, you had the forced removal of the native onto reservations, coupled with slavery, followed by segregation. Imagine all three of those things happening to the same group of people at the same time. That was apartheid.
You're listening to 88.3 FM WAER, your local NPR station from Syracuse University. I'm Joe Lee, and I'm joined by Dean Brian Kunkel of Hendricks Chapel at Syracuse University, and four outstanding Syracuse University freshman students, Allison Weiss, Hadia Lee, Brian Hudnell, and Dasi Comeggio. We're discussing the Syracuse Reads Shared Academic Experience and the book assigned to all incoming freshmen and transfer students, Born a Crime, written by Comedy Central's Trevor Noah. We pick up the discussion on diversity and inclusion. And Dean, what was the the intended outcome in terms of diversity and inclusion that you were that the school was hoping to get from this book and Trevor Noah's experience?
Sure. There's a number of different outcomes that one could point to, but I would say part of it's the reality that some would argue that diversity is a fact and inclusion is a goal. And so South Africa was a diverse place for many years, but inclusion was not the reality. So part of what Trevor Noah is articulating in the text is both diversity and inclusion, something that we, of course, are very committed to at Syracuse University and something that we want to articulate honestly, openly, and repeatedly as much as possible. So the text brings that out, and it forces each and every one of us to think about our own realities and how each and every one of us can contribute, not just pointing out the facts, but also pointing towards the goal.
I like how in the book he sort of highlighted his own, at times, unconscious bias. So if you take the scene where he was in jail, there was a man who was brought to jail. He described him as a very big man. He called him like a black Hulk. He was huge. He looked mean and looked menacing. Those are the identities that he assigned to him because he didn't know this man. And so in order to fill in the gaps of information that he didn't know, that's what he assigned to him. He must be huge. He's in jail. He must be mean. He must be a menace. And I might be in trouble. And then he describes the difficulty that the prison guard had with communicating with the man. And he noticed that he spoke a certain tribal language and that because of his Trevor Noah's stepfather, he was somewhat familiar with that language and began to talk to the man and find out that he was in there under similar circumstances that he was. Petty theft, that he was unemployed, struggling to provide for his family, decided to steal some video games, sell them for a profit, and support his family. So he was a very nice man, a very gentle man, and nothing like the information and the assignment that he put on him at first seeing him. Were any of you struck by sort of those examples of unconscious bias? Are you guys aware of your own unconscious bias? And how do you see yourselves fitting in diverse situations?
I definitely am. I am subject to unconscious bias, and I recognize that I have unconscious biases. For example, usually when I see people that are not of color, so white people, European people, I assume that they have some kinds of privileges. I mean, they do have some kind of privileges, but I assume that, for example, that they are but more well off, for example, so they don't have to deal with problems that low income people do. And then to find out when you start talking to people, you can't just assume their backgrounds. You can't automatically assume they come from well-off families, they come from well-off environments, because they really could have not had the best lives. And it's very telling because you really have to view people as individuals, and it's hard to break past very superficial things like race and appearance. But you just have to talk to people. When you get to know people and you talk to people, you see that your biases, they have no foundings.
Did any of you come to sort of think about that while you were reading this, or are you just responding because I'm asking a question? Did you? What I'm trying to get at is did the reading assignment help you think about things like unconscious bias?
It definitely helped me think about unconscious bias and how we can, you know, combat stereotypes and prejudice, because I think it's safe to say that everyone in the world has some sort of unconscious bias. When you meet someone, you are automatically, you know, assigning a category or a judgment to them. And anyone that says that they don't do that is wrong, and they're lying to everyone else and they're lying to themselves. So I think that one of the main ways to combat these biases and prejudices is to admit that they're there and ask ourselves why they're there, and then kind of break down the barriers and talk to people and get to know them and realize that, you know, they don't fit into the stereotypes of, you know, their race or their religion and stuff like that. And the book definitely helped me see that because, you know, Trevor Noah, you know, he's extremely diverse. He's from a diverse community. He still has unconscious bias. Like, everyone has them. It's okay to admit that you do. But you have to admit and talk through it to kind of combat them.
And I'm looking at the two of you, Hadiya and Dasi. And I don't want to make any judgments. Allison and Brian seem to have sort of traditional American names. Dasi and Hadiya are not. You're both brown-skinned. Are there instances where people are trying to assign something to you based on your name and the way you look in conversations that they have with you? Are they trying to figure out where you're from, what your background is? Do you experience that at all?
Yeah, definitely. I worked as a cashier at Wegmans back in Rochester, New York. And all of the time, you would get people, oh, where are you from? Oh, where are your parents from? Just automatically assuming that I'm not from here. I mean, I am from here. My parents are immigrants. But it's interesting that that's the first thing you think of when you look at me, not like who I am as a person. It's because I'm not where my parents are from. I'm not my skin tone. I am me. So if you just, like, look at people and you automatically, when you look at white people, for example, you're not looking at them thinking, oh, where are you from? Like, that name is not from here, as if a name can be from somewhere. So I've had, like, those frustrating experiences. But I've learned to, like, just brush past it because it's not worth it to get, like, upset about, because it's just that unconscious bias once again.
I have had the same exact experiences as Dasi. I've found that people automatically want to put each other into categories for their own peace of mind, you know, gender, race, sexuality, and so on and so forth, so that they could identify people, know how to address them, have an idea of what to expect for them. But those categories are very limiting, and Trevor Noah discovered this as he was talking to that man in jail, and he discovered that they actually had many similarities and that they connected to each other on a much deeper level than he would have ever assumed if he was just going off of those categories.
And we all sort of belong to some sort of category. Do you find times, Allison, where people are trying to place you in a category?
Well, I would say that, you know, a typical, like, just talking about, you know, religion, a typical, you know, stereotypical Jewish person has brown hair and brown eyes and, you know, maybe stereotypically like a large nose for some reason. And I don't look like that. I am blonde and I have blue eyes, and the rest of my family does. So, you know, I've had times where, you know, people, you know, they're like, oh, like, what is your, like, even when I'm at Temple, some people are like, oh, like, are you part of this family? Did you convert? Stuff like that. I think it's a very, very transformative thing, like, across religions and across races. Like, everyone does that. There are stereotypes associated with religions and races all across the board.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, we're having these conversations in this day and age, because everyone has, you know, some sort of unconscious bias. When we don't know information about someone, you know, we unconsciously are trying to assign that information to come to some sort of agreement with ourselves about what we think that person is. Dean, I was struck by this quote from Nelson Mandela. If you talk to a man in a language he understands, that goes to his head. If you talk to a man in his language, that goes to his heart.
The power of communication, right? It's powerful. And of course, this book brings that to light when you're thinking about a country that has, at the time, 11 official languages. The power of language, the power of communication, and the way in which that communication is received. And of course, this very specific nature of communication in an apartheid South Africa, it's powerful. And for us to bring that light to our own experience about insiders and outsiders and how we speak to one another, the language that we choose, the ways in which we choose to include some and exclude others. Mandela, of course, a powerful communicator himself and leading a post-apartheid South Africa, this is something that he himself had to navigate a great deal. And it's something that South Africa continues to navigate decades later.
You mentioned insider-outsider, and insider-outsider dynamics are all through this book. And a lot of times, Trevor Noah seems to know sort of where he fits in, and a lot of times he really does not know where he fits in. There was a passage in the book, an incident under a mulberry tree, where he was in a neighborhood. He is a what they would consider colored, and there were other kids playing under the mulberry tree, and just treated him poorly, pelted him with the fruit because he was different. But he saw himself, and these were black kids, he saw himself as black, but they didn't see him as black. And that was sort of a powerful scene. Absolutely. You were going to say something.
I was going to say something. On our walk up here, Dassey and I had a conversation about the different languages here on Syracuse University. We talked about how there are many transfer students here who speak different languages, come from different places, and that kind of creates a divide here on campus because while you may want to get to know people and have conversations with people, people do feel most comfortable in their own languages, and that can be a hard bridge to get across.
And how do we get across that bridge?
I was just going to say that language has played a big role in my life because my parents are from Cameroon, which is with official languages, it's a bilingual country, French and English. So I had to learn French growing up so I could communicate with my family from Cameroon. But they also, in addition to French, they have their language that they speak in their village, which I never really learned. And I definitely feel that divide there, like that you're talking about, especially with my older family members who sometimes exclusively speak in the language from their village. And I wish that I had learned it so that I could communicate with them and contact them on a deeper level, because speaking French is all well and good, but that French is not the language of their forefathers. French was imposed onto them. So it would help if I spoke their language, and it would language in general, when you how it goes to your heart. That's true. Like, people trust you. I find that people trust you more when you speak their language, because it's a form of recognition. And it's very funny because when you take a country like the United States, where when you speak any other language than English, you're told that you don't belong there. When language is really the great connector, and it should not be the great divider.
So in instances where your family is speaking in their native tongue that you don't, you immediately feel like an outsider. And so we can probably see how when international students come to our campus on a campus where the predominant language is English, if they struggle with that language, they're probably feeling like outsiders as well.
I also think it's interesting to look at kind of the history of America and how we have used language or lack of language as a weapon. And I think that Trevor Noah kind of connects apartheid to the way that we were treating the slaves and the fact that we took language away from them because, you know, the slave owners thought that they would, like, conspire with their own language. So they said that they, you know, weren't allowed to talk. And if they were talking, they were super suspicious. So they kind of built another language through song and oral traditions and stuff like that. But the lack of language was definitely used as a weapon to try and stop all communication in their native tongue.
This is a great topic, the way we use language here in the United States, and also taking it into the book. And the book talks about the use of Afrikaans as a language in South Africa. And, of course, the standardization of Afrikaans in South Africa gave birth to a number of protests, some of the most famous of which were students themselves, most notably the Hector Peterson massacre in Soweto. And so Trevor Noah grows up in the midst of this, and it provides us with a point of reflection of the way that we use language, whose language is imposed upon who, and how is it that we find ways to communicate together and to build a sense of a common good and to be mindful of the ways in which we speak to one another, the ways that we listen to each other. It's a powerful connection that we make with the book.
Yeah, insider-outsider dynamics. We could spend the entire show talking about this stuff. You're listening to Syracuse Reads on 88.3 FM WAER and online at waer.org. I'm Joe Lee. We'll have some final reflections when we return.
Language brings with it an identity and a culture, or at least the perception of it. A shared language says, we're the same. A language barrier says, we're different. The architects of apartheid understood this. Part of the effort to divide Black people was to make sure we were separated not just physically, but by language as well. The great thing about language is that you can just as easily use it to do the opposite.
WAER is happy to be part of your community, but we realize that a lot of times you're on the go. Or maybe you can't connect with WAER. And that's why we've developed the WAER mobile app, so you can take us with you wherever you go. Stream our broadcast, browse our website, and listen to the latest on-demand audio. Available in the Apple and Google Play Store. Just search for WAER.
To this day, I hate secondhand cars. Almost everything that's ever gone wrong in my life, I can trace back to a secondhand car. Secondhand cars made me get detention for being late for school. Secondhand cars left us hitchhiking on the side of the freeway. A secondhand car was also the reason my mom got married. If it hadn't been for the Volkswagen that didn't work, we never would have looked for the mechanic who became the husband, who became the stepfather, who became the man who tortured us for years and put a bullet in the back of my mother's head. I'll take the new car with the warranty every time.
Amen. Amen.
Those are excerpts from Trevor Noah's book, read by Syracuse University students and Syracuse University staff. This is Syracuse Reads, a special hour of conversation on the SU Shared Academic Reading Assignment, Born a Crime. It's been a great conversation, so let's get some final reflections on the book, its author, the shared academic experience, and what our students expect out of their time here at Syracuse University. Did this book enhance your worldview at any point? Did it cause you to think about your own identity in any way or how you perceive others? Let's hear from our students and find out sort of what were your takeaways?
I would say from reading the book, definitely led me to examine my identity more and how, I tried to appeal to certain groups, which, led me to have a conflicted sense of identity. And I think that just, not even just in the United States and, like in a global sense, that it's very easy for people to want to put people into boxes and this is where the whole idea of intersectionality comes into play because, I'm Black, but I'm also a woman, or I'm also a child of immigrants. Many different identities coming into play. And it's like, it's just about having like multiple layers of identities, and that people are not just one thing. People are not just what you perceive them as. People are who they are. From like the mainstream perspective, like the predominant group, especially like on this college campus, for example, predominantly white institution, that it's not like the key is to basically like communicate with people of different backgrounds, and not just people who look different from you, because that's not the only indicator. Like, people from all walks of life, you get involved in different activities, like step out of what you normally do, because that's that quote about oppressors don't live with the people that they oppress, because if they did, then they would like see the error of their ways, and like they would change how they function. So it's really about just getting to know people of different walks of life, and that's the first step to undoing systems of oppression.
Allison, how did you feel about the assignment, and what are your reflections?
I think that one of the most important things that I took away from Trevor Noah's memoir is really how to be a global citizen. I think that as being a part of a country that enjoys traveling and, seeing other cultures and taking in other cultures so much, it's really important to know how to show people that, you know, we understand their culture and we respect their culture. And one of the ways that Trevor Noah taught us how to do that is through language. He has that quote where he says, you know, you can talk to someone in a shared language, you know, which for most people would, you know, be English. A lot of foreign countries also speak English. But if you talk to someone in their language, you're showing that you really respect them and you respect where they've come from. And I think that if you're traveling to a different country, just learning a few words of Italian or French or Hungarian really shows that you're trying, instead of saying to literally everyone you meet, oh, do you speak English? Please talk to me in English. I'm American. And I think that another really important thing that Trevor Noah's memoir taught me was to make sure that I'm constantly, you know, checking the privileges that I have and the privilege that I was born with being a white citizen of the global North. I think that what many people who are relatively well off don't realize is that there are people right next to you who are going through a lot of struggles, including like poverty. You know, their parents are losing jobs. They're having trouble paying for their food even. You know, there's a food bank in my local town, which, you know, a lot of people would consider wealthy. But there are a lot of people who you don't realize are not doing as well off as you think they are. Because, you know, I think that a lot of people who have a lot of privileges sometimes wear a mask, where they like to see the world as, you know, a really great place because that's what it is for them. But I think that Trevor Noah taught us that a lot of people are going through not great situations. The most important thing that he taught me personally was just to be thankful for everything you have and realize that you really should give back to people who don't have as much as you.
Hadia.
The book, the biggest message I got from the book is that we're not in this alone. We're all connected to each other through relationships or through our experiences, and everything we do is in relation to other people around us, and we have to take that into account when we act, and we have to take into account how our actions will affect other people.
Brian.
This book really made me think about diversity and inclusion. I mean, if you look at me, I'm a white male. Like, I'm the prototypical, like, I am the least oppressed kind of demographic, I guess you could say. And although I do have problems, I'm willing to admit that these problems probably aren't as significant as what other people in the minority probably are experiencing. And we probably all have a tendency to kind of react on our first stereotype and leave it at that. But this book really made me think of really taking the time to get to know someone, know their background, know what they, you know, what different experiences they've had in their life. Because I mentioned before, I really didn't know too much about Trevor Noah other than he was a comedian on TV. And then really getting to learn more about him was pretty cool, I thought, because I get to learn about a period of our period of history that really doesn't get talked about as much as it should. And I think it really opened my eyes to what different people during that time was experiencing and how we can apply that to our interactions today.
Dean, when we hear Brian speak about his issues and things not being maybe as important as others, that's not quite true. I mean, your issues' importance is just as important as others. And we have been, I think, in general sort of talking about diversity and inclusion in terms of race, but there are other categories that we all fall into that that we need to be conscious about. What are some of the reflections that you have? And from these conversations, do you think the assignment hit the mark?
Yeah. Well, my first takeaway is gratitude. Thankful for the faculty, students, staff that helped to make this opportunity possible. Of course, thankful that Trevor Noah wrote the book and thankful that so many students not only picked it up and not only read the words, but absorbed it, engaged with it, let it sink in, let it serve as a mirror to their own realities. And I'm thankful that we'll have Trevor Noah on campus for the Martin Luther King celebration in January. So I don't know if any assignment fully hits the mark, but I'm glad that we're having conversations about matters that matter. We're talking about our connectivity as a global society, and one of the ways that we reshape our connectivity is by reshaping our conversations. So we're delighted that we had difficult conversations, conversations that matter, and I think that we can all feel worthwhile that we're a part of something creating solutions in the midst of so many problems in our day and age today.
Now, this was the first of this kind. We will be doing this going forward.
That's
as a
the
university?
Plan. That's the plan.
Okay. Any last thoughts? Anybody want to talk about what their favorite part of the book was, either the funniest or the thing that was most touching?
Brian said something interesting about how his experiences are maybe not as significant, his issues are not as significant as others. And I thought this was kind of a key moment in the book. One of my favorite moments is when Trevor Noah and his friends went to that, I believe it was a Jewish school, and they were dancing and they were cheering on their friend Hitler, and they had no idea the significance that Hitler and that history had on the Jewish community. And the people at the school had no idea that their lack of education made them unaware, and they assumed that they were being made fun of and that it was in malice, and there was a huge miscommunication. But I think the message that I really got out of that moment in the story is that our experiences are personal to us, and we look at our own histories and give them a certain amount of significance and downplay other people's histories, but it's all subjective and it's all up to the individual, and it's our job as individuals to recognize the importance of other people's stories.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for sharing what you've learned and your experience. It's been an enlightening discussion. Thank you, Dean Konkle, for helping us to explore this topic. I want to thank Allison, Hadia, Brian, and Dassey for sharing their experiences with us, and I wish you all a great deal of success here at Syracuse University, and welcome to the university. And I want to thank our producer, Kevin Kloss. If you haven't read the book, Born a Crime by Trevor Noah, we encourage you to grab a copy and mark your calendars for Trevor Noah's appearance at the 34th annual MLK celebration taking place on Sunday, January 27th in the Carrier Dome. Tickets are available online at mlk.syr.edu, at the Carrier Dome box office, or by calling 315-443-2121. I'm Joe Lee. Thanks for listening.